I'd rather be here doing my time than make any choice that the government ever gave me to tell on anybody in this world. I just wouldn't do it. I'd rather be here than on a street as one of them stool pigeons.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. I'm here in the classic old Ice House building with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, Aaron and I, first of all, want to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, or Happy Holidays, depending on how politically correct you want to be. This is going to be our Christmas show, kind of a abbreviated show, and we're going to talk a little bit about what's going on over the next month or two, particularly the following month. You guys from Chicago will be happy to know that this is going to be the outfit all month, all the time, nothing but Chicago outfit stories. We're going to have a couple of live interviews. We'll kick it off with Media Mondays. My show always drops on early on Monday morning, and I'm going to have a different newspaper reporter that's covered the mob for the next several months. We already have those interviews in the bag, and we've got John Bulldog Drummond for the very first show. I know you guys will like that, and he is a heck of an interview. That guy is, he has his finger on the pulse of the Chicago outfit and has for a long time. But tonight, I'll do a quick show tonight for you guys. And we really appreciate your support over the last year. We look forward to the next year in 2018, bringing you some more stories. Over the last several months, we have interviewed some former mob members like Frank Culotta. Now, a couple of these shows aren't up yet. Andrew DiDonato, who was a Gambino soldier. Frank Calabrese Jr., who will be, you guys from Chicago know him. He has a Chicago mob tour. And that'll be in this next outfit month. January will be Chicago outfit month from here on out. These guys are all living, shall we say, above the ground. And only of all of them, only Frank Culotta went in the witness protection program, and he's since come back out. Two of them, Frank Culotta and Frank Calabrese Jr., are running mob tours. So they're easy to find, easy to get hold of. Andrew DiDonato, I noticed that he didn't say where he was. He talked about not going, being able to go back home to see his son, we didn't go into great detail at
where he was doing so much, other than that he had a book and the fact that he's not doing a Brooklyn mob tour.
No, he's not doing a Brooklyn mob tour. Maybe he'll have sometime in the future. And in the past, there's been a real popular mob myth that if you ever testify against them, you're a dead man walking. They're going to get you no matter what and no matter where. And there are some examples of that. And the feds, because of that, because for every stereotype, there's always comes from some grains of truth. The feds developed that very elaborate witness protection program and took in Henry Hill and Frank Culotta both until they just figured out they could go out and do public appearances and make money, which both of them did. And Henry Hill died a natural death. Frank Culotta is still running his casino mob tour. If you want to go back and hear a story of a guy in the witness protection program we stumbled across here in Kansas City, listen to our story about the Milwaukee leg breaker. He's a relocated witness that I was part of an investigation and caught him dealing some marijuana here in Kansas City. When we uncovered that, the U.S. attorney called us in, the DEA and some of my guys in, and said, you don't really have a decent case on this guy. Maybe a couple of little hand-to-hand buys. We're just going to send him on to another city and give him another name. So we don't know what happened to him. I think he died after that. I think somebody told me that he died.
Well, that sounds to me like, I don't know. When you can you find a list of people that you know of that went into witness relocation and maybe died? I doubt it. Natural death, or maybe if they're Ned Day and they drowned or had a heart attack while swimming or fishing in Hawaii.
He wasn't in the witness protection program. Right. So they don't always get you, kind of is what. But I'm going to tell you a couple of stories tonight about when they did get you. The most famous alumni of the witness protection program is probably Sammy the Bull Gravano. And while he was in, he caught a case for dealing ecstasy down in the southwest part of the United States and ended up being reincarcerated and convicted under his real name. And he survived that few years in the penitentiary, and he was recently released. I saw it all over Facebook and the mob interest sites that he's been released under his real name. So Sammy the Bull is out there living under his real name. He was a guy that was responsible to get Gotti convicted finally. And Gotti's got relatives and friends and tons of stuff out there. I think Sammy the Bull ought to lay low. You know, a couple of stories that got this myth started were right out of Chicago. Our friends from Chicago. 1943, 1944, there was an outfit informer named Willie Bioff. He ended up testifying against Frank Nitti, Paul the Waiter Rica, and Johnny Roselli, and several others. I think Cherry Nose, GOE. They had a conspiracy to extort money from Hollywood film producers. 10 years later, after Willie Bioff testifies in 1945, right at the end of the war in 1955, he was living under an assumed name. There was no witness protection program back then, under the name of Willie Nelson in Phoenix, Arizona. And he was not laying very low. He was using this other name, but he was around and he was out, and he had connected up with a couple of other mob guys who were kind of retired out there. Jewish gambler out of, I believe he was out of Cleveland, became the Las Vegas mayor. He also became a strong casino owner for a lot of mob money back east, Chicago and Cleveland and even New York. He was caught skimming some money for his own personal use from the outfit-controlled Riviera Casino. This was before Tony Spilotro was sent out by the outfit. Johnny Roselli was the Chicago's outfit man to oversee all their action in Vegas. He ordered Gus Greenbaum to sell out his share and leave the casino. Greenbaum refused. He left town. He did move out of town, but he still owned his shares of the Riviera. He moved to a suburb near Phoenix, Arizona called Encanto Park. Later that same year, he was just living under his own name, and he and his wife both are found slashed to death in a murder that remains unsolved today. And police at the time always suspected that it was the outfit. Johnny Roselli later in life would be overheard claiming that Mayor Lansky had owned a piece of the Riviera, and he was the one who had actually pushed for this murder. So Gus Greenbaum, he had angered mob bosses from Chicago to New York, the very top echelon of them. Now, the third story is Louis Bombacino. He was an outfit bookmaker in the 1960s. And this is still, Aaron, this is still before the witness protection program.
They didn't even have that in the 50s and 60s?
No, they didn't have it till the 70s.
They just showed up at your door and said, you better move.
Yes, yes. Might help you. They might help you a little bit.
Witness relocation was a pair of suitcases.
Yep, and a bus ticket out of town. And depending on a lot of your own resources. There wasn't a lot of money in the bank. They had some. And they helped Louis Bombacino out a little bit.
Well, but much like a lot of these guys, then they get to wherever that destination is, they're going to kind of lay low, and it still costs to live. And,
you got to get a job. You got to have a Social Security number.
You got to get some action.
You got to do something. Yeah. Or you can go out and do more crime. Then you end up getting caught. Let me tell you a little bit about this case that he helped the FBI make on the outfit. He was in jail and in the Cook County jail on a charge of robbery. FBI agents heard about it, went in to visit him at the jail, which they often do. I've done this myself, and offered a little help with his case. Lou felt like he was on his last legs anyhow. He probably didn't feel like he wasn't that old a guy. He's in his 30s, I believe, but I think he felt like he couldn't do another stretch in the joint. He agreed, and eventually he will receive a 5-year probation. So they got him out of jail pretty quick after that, helped him post his bond. And then delayed the court case for a while. That's what you always do. You delay the court case till you've always got that hanging over their head in case they want to think about pissing backwards on you. Once they get him out on the streets, they start giving him some money. According to some of the things I was able to learn, they gave him a total of $3,000 over the next couple of years. But he also was able to make a lot of money working with the outfit and not have to worry about getting arrested and having to pay lawyers and catching a case over bookmaking, his bookmaking activities. He knew an outfit bookmaker named Frank Arelli, who worked for Jackie the Lackey Cerrone. And Jackie the Lackey Cerrone at that time was a leader of what they called the Elmwood Park crew. He first obtained a job just through this Arelli. Jackie the Lackey didn't even know him at first, a real low-level job just delivering what they called baseball betting sheets to a sausage stand guy who would then pass them out to other people, a little bit like parlay cards, and then you'd go back to your bookmaker. The sheets would have the pitchers, the odds, and a lot of sports information on upcoming baseball games. And then after he'd pass out those baseball betting sheets, he'd go to an apartment that was set up just to take sports bets over the phone. So during this time, he had two employers. He was working for the outfit and the bookmaking, and for the FBI, who were paying him a little bit of money all along.
This was while he was on probation.
Well, he was probably out on bond. He probably got that.
Oh, he subsequently received 5 years
probation.
Right,
right. What I would do, if I were his control, I would go to the prosecutor and keep getting continuances and continuances, so you've always got that over his head till he actually does something for you and makes a case. As he became more and more valuable, because he was a good worker, he was given more responsibility, and pretty soon he kind of had his own book. He was taking his own bets over his home phone. Joe Ferriola, who will eventually succeed Joey Iupa when he goes to the prison in the 1980s Vegas skimming trial, ended up being connected to this conspiracy because he was the one that brought Bombacino in to a little higher level at a meeting on June the 25th, 1965. And during the next year, as Bombacino increased his stature as a bookmaker, he would eventually testify that he was ordered to go to a meeting on December the 28th, 1966, directly with Jackie the Lackey Cerrone. Now, we've talked about these nicknames. I'm going to interject something here, Aaron. You know why he got the name Jackie the Lackey? It seemed like a kind of how would a mob boss have a name Jackie the Lackey, other than it rhymes?
I'm not sure.
Well, what I was able to learn, that the media, as we talked about this, sometimes the newspapers give you the nickname, sometimes your friends give you the nickname, maybe your parents have given you a nickname you grew up with. But in this case, the news media gave him the nickname because he was always driving, every time they saw him, he was driving the boss, Anthony Accardo, around, so they called him, he was Accardo's lackey. So because it rhymed, they named him Jackie the Lackey, and it stuck.
So he's driving Accardo around, and what happens to Accardo?
Well, Accardo, and he goes to this meeting on June 25th, 1965, with Jackie the Lackey and Anthony Accardo, and one of the outfit's true powers behind the scene. If you study the outfit during this time, you'll hear the name Paul the Waiter Rica. And he seems important, but he's not doing it. It doesn't seem like he's doing anything. Well, hindsight's always 20/20. Eventually, like out of this case, they'll find out that he, everything has to be run by him. Bombacino will testify that Jackie Cerrone was the Elmwood Park crew boss and was his boss in the bookmaking scheme. He will also testify that when he went to this meeting, it was at a restaurant, a Northside Chicago restaurant named Mayo's, M-E-O-S. And he sat at a table with Jackie the Lackey, and Paul the Waiter Rica was sitting at that same table.
He probably didn't call him Lackey, though, did he?
No, nobody did but the news. He testifies that Cerrone looked over at Rica and told him that Bombacino was be given a job as a bookmaker for them. He'll also testify that Paul the Waiter nodded his head, indicating approval, and said, okay. Bombacino testifies that Jackie Lackey said he has heard nothing but favorable reports about him and welcomes him into the fold as a full-fledged bookmaker. Cerrone's cousin, James Cerrone, was shown to be a conspirator of this bookmaking scheme by meeting with his brother Jack, or his cousin Jack Cerrone, and Lou Bombacino the very next day, December the 29th, 1966. And he explained to Bombacino the methodology of taking certain bets after Jack Cerrone had, advised him that he would be now servicing some additional big bettors. The 1970 trial for this bookmaking operation, Bombacino's testimony would force this reclusive Paul the Waiter Rica to come into court and testify under a grant of immunity. They didn't convict him of anything.
Yeah, but when they give him immunity, they're getting him to testify against the mob. That's
right.
Pretty dangerous.
And he didn't really, Paul the Waiter didn't really testify against them, but they had him there, they granted him immunity, and when they asked him these questions, he had to admit that, yeah, I know Jackie Cerrone. Yeah, I met with him at different restaurants. Oh, I don't really remember meeting at this particular restaurant, but yeah, I do that. So they kind of, what they did is they showed the jury that this was part of a bigger scheme, that other people have to give their approval for certain activities. They really didn't have enough, any other evidence that he was getting any proceeds or that he was given any other instructions in the, it's just part of the whole thing. Everything doesn't have to be, it's like a death of a thousand cuts for Jackie Cerrone and the other bookmakers to show that this was an outfit controlled bookmaking scheme that they had.
Well, wasn't part of this Bombacino simply turning state's evidence about the bookmaking activities? And then he's like, here I am in a meeting with Jackie the lackey and the waiter, and this is what they say, and they nod their heads, and I have to change how I do my bookmaking. I mean, that guy's a pretty cool character to sit there and do that, knowing that he's going to be turning some evidence and, you know, getting paid by the FBI.
Sure. He'd been working for him for 3 years at that point in time and worked his way up from running errands to being a full-fledged bookmaker with his own book. He did a heck of a job.
$3,000. I'd ask for a raise from the FBI.
Yeah, you know, and that's what I found. Maybe they gave him more money. You never know. And Paul the Waiter at this time, he was deathly ill. He will die within about 2 years. I think he dies in 1972, and this trial was in 1970. They brought him in on a hospital gurney and then put him in a wheelchair, and he had to testify from wheelchair. All the defendants were convicted, all the mob guys, there's a whole bunch of others. I won't bore you with the details of all the names because you never heard of them. What got me onto this, I happened to see an article about Lou Bombacino in Mike Burns, the Chicago Outfit, Old and Current News and Articles Facebook page. And our friend Red Mamet, he's part of that. He's one of the administrators on that page. And he had posted a Tribune article about Louis Bombacino, and that was about Bombacino's 1975 murder, which would be 5 years after he testified. The article said that Bombacino had been living in a Phoenix suburb. It was Tempe, Arizona. I think I've heard of that, Tempe, Arizona. Tempe. It's a pretty good sized suburb, I think.
Arizona State University there.
That's right, of Tempe. That's true.
Sun Devils. That's where I went to college for four years.
They have great baseball teams out there. We know it's named our little league team, the Sun Devils. They found out that he'd been living there since 1967. He had moved out there, actually, with his wife while he was working undercover before the trial, because the trial wasn't until 1970. His wife and he had a teenage son at this point in time. And October the 6th, 1975, Louis Bombacino left his house, entered his brand-new Lincoln Continental, and an explosive device went off, and they described it as containing plastic explosives rather than dynamite or black powder or anything. And it was wired either to the accelerator or the steering wheel, or I've seen a pressure switch where you put it up underneath the car, and when the person sits down, the car dips down a little bit and it will push a plunger into the package. So somehow it was wired up, so when he got in it and did something, it went off and it blew out 75 windows in the neighborhood.
Man.
Papers report he was living under the name of Joseph Nardi at that point in time. He had a job, and Mike Byrne explained this. He says, I'll just quote from Mike. He says, yep, the unfortunate part is that Louis Bombacino was fired from his job in Arizona for theft. After he was killed, it came out that Bombacino had never committed the theft, and he had been wrongly accused by his employer, and he had already filed a lawsuit against his old employer because he knew they couldn't prove that he had done this theft. But when he filed the lawsuit, he used his own name. If he had used his new name, he might not have surfaced, but using his own name, somebody must have picked up on that and sent the word back to Chicago. Mike says, I have no idea why he would use his real name in that lawsuit. Very strange. And I have to agree with you, Mike. That's very strange why you would use your own real name when you already set up. Now, see, this wasn't an official. I don't know how he got his driver's license, but somehow he was living under this other name, but they didn't have the witness protection program then. So he didn't have all those connections with governmental agencies to give you a new driver's license, a new birth certificate, all kinds of new stuff under the new name. I think he's just living ad hocly under that old name. He might even still been driving a car under his old name and still had his old Social Security number for sure. So he may have had to file a lawsuit under his real name. Who knows?
Well, or maybe he had all these fake documents that didn't really lead to anybody. And, you know, they said Joseph Nardi.
Yeah.
If he got stopped, there's this maybe a degree you can pair a Social Security number to it or any of that other stuff. I think fake documents, you know, false identities are pretty easy to manufacture.
Well, back then in 1975, it was a no-brainer to do it. As long as you had
You could get a birth certificate.
Yeah, you could go get a birth certificate and fabricate your own back then. You can't anymore, but you could have back then. I don't know how they did it. I mean, what all the circumstances were. But the point of this story is that they did get him.
Yeah, because
5 years
later,
they got him.
That's kind of odd, though, that, I mean, he was living in Tempe, Arizona before he testified, which I would think they maybe have known that.
You know, I don't know. The article, I couldn't learn that much more about the case. He could have moved his wife and kid down there, not really said anything. And, you know, then so when he ended up testifying, then he just leaves and goes down where they're already set up living. You know, I don't really know.
Maybe it was just that a lot of old mobsters that testify moved to Phoenix.
They seem to like to move to the South. I don't blame them. Anyhow,
the weather, I think that's what Frank Culotta.
Yeah.
All right. Or Frank Calabrese might say.
Yeah, I think he lived down in the southwest part of the United States, too. He's back in Chicago now, though. Anyhow, so moving right along, let's finish this off, Aaron. If you have a friend or relative with a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron? And Merry Christmas to everybody, and Happy New Year, and we will talk to you next year.
I got to say, Merry Christmas. You just did that. I know. And
You need to do that.
No, I know. Well, but maybe we can both do it. I don't know. What I have to say, of course, is what you need to do is get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to purchase, or you could make a donation of $25. And if you live in the United States, Gary will send you a DVD copy that he autographs personally. And there are some extras on there that you cannot get if you want to get that on Amazon for $7. And there's some great interviews with some of those original folks involved in the skimming trials in Las Vegas. And then what you want to do? Get the Kansas City Mob Tour app. Because for like $1.99 on your iPhone, you can take your own personalized tour of all these notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. Plus, you want to get the latest edition of Gary's written work, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And when you read that book, when you read that book, you're going to want to hear the words from the mouth of the men that did it. And there's a Kindle version you can buy for like $1.99. Download that. There's hyperlinks to video clips with the actual audio from the wiretaps they used to convict the men skimming from the casinos in Vegas.
All right. Say goodnight, Aaron. Merry Christmas.
Say Merry Christmas, Aaron.
Say Merry Christmas, Aaron.
Merry Christmas, Aaron.
Good night, everybody.
What do you do for a living?
I invoke my right under the Fifth Amendment of the United States Constitution and decline to answer the question.
Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.